You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett, and I'll be here for the next 2 hours. But first, a big thank you to those who have pledged support for the Radiothon to this program. We're turning 50 next year, so your donation will help us all celebrate. Many thanks to a number of people who I can read out now. Jim Crosswaite, Ron Guy, Cam Walker, Sue Wareham, Paul Daly, Dale Hess, Alison Brynoska, Nick McClellan, the Freedom Socialist Party, Debbie Brennan, Heather Smith and Don Stokes, and Juliet Fox. And I'll read some more out through the program. But many thanks to all of those wonderful people, all there to keep 3CR on air for another year. And I'm sure others will support the program as well. To support the work I do throughout the year with the assistance of the wonderful Juliet Fox. But it's not too late. It's never too late. We haven't reached our target yet. You can contact the station on 039 419 8377 during office hours or go to the webpage 3cr.org.au/donate and follow the prompts. Don't forget to mention this program when you pledge. And if you donate today or any time during the week, I'll announce your name on the program next week. So today we hear about the power of the Zionist lobby in Australia, part one of a webinar featuring journalist Wendy Bacon and Yukov Aharon speaking with Ahmed Alabalda. Announcing the winner of the 2025 Sydney Peace Prize, the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, Judge Lavi Pillay. Emeritus Professor Stuart West will be there to talk about the nearly 30 years history of the award and the work of Navi. Journalist with Islands Business, Nick McClellan, looking back on recent UN conferences on the ocean and what was achieved in the recent ones and what we hope is going to achieve in this one. Social commentator John Kurupel and a history of China, which seeks to explain the present day. And again, that number to ring, 039 419 8377 or 3cr.org.au/donations. And thank you. Part one of an edited online conversation between Ahmed Alabadra and Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon. The topic, promoting Israel in Australia, the influence of the Israel lobby on Australian politics and media. We begin with Ahmed, a part of Palestine Justice Movement in Sydney.
The Zionist regime, leadership and society has proven to us time and time again over the past 20 months that it is not worthy of being part of the international community. It is losing the legal and moral support of the public opinion. It is becoming a pariah regime, although in a frustratingly slow pace. If it wasn't for the international support that this genocide regime is getting from the Western sponsors, including the US and this country, the state of Israel could never sustain its genocidal campaign in Gaza and Palestine for this long. Many argue, at least in the US, that the Zionist lobby gets all the credit for maintaining the American support for the state of Israel. Some argue that similar arrangements are taking place in this country, whereby the Israeli lobby wields a great influence on our political infrastructure, as well as academia and media. Coming out of the 2025 federal election today, we will zoom in on the Israel lobby's influence on our media and politics, with some focus on the recent election. This is an incredibly important topic. This is evidenced by the number of people who are attending today and the number of registrations. We have more than 600 registrations to this webinar. I am delighted today to be in conversation with two journalists who are very well informed and have written extensively on the matter. It gives me pleasure to be in conversation with Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon. Wendy Bacon is an independent investigative journalist and lifelong radical activist. She has investigated miscarriages of justice, deaths in custody, News Corp's coverage of climate change, urban developments, police corruption, and most recently, astroturfing in the 2025 federal election. Welcome, Wendy, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yaakov Aharon is new to journalism, having come from a background of activism. Yaakov brings unique perspectives to the Palestinian struggle, credited to his political journey away from the ultra-Orthodox Jewish and pro-Israel education of his youth. His research concerns the Israel lobby, Jewish community, party politics, and arms trade. Welcome, Yaakov, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks, everyone.
This question is for both of you, really, but I do want to start with you, Yaakov. I'd like to delve straight away into the conversation by outlining the main Israel lobbying groups in Australia. We know about this invisible force that is called Israel Lobby, but we also know that it's normally formed by a number of organizations. Can you give us an insight on what these organizations are? You know, what are their legal statuses as well? Briefly, how they operate.
A lot of what I know about the Israel Lobby comes from having seen the way it works as a child, you know, as I came of age. One of my first jobs was actually with the Jewish Board of Deputies. You could say I'm atoning for my sins now by spilling out the dirt more than a decade ago. So I've obviously been on a political journey away from that. But I remember on day one when I worked at the Jewish Board of Deputies, they showed me to my desk, you know, told me where the bathroom is, so on. And then they said, well, this is what you need to know. First thing they said, we don't criticize current Israeli government policy. And really, that's a rule across the board for all these Jewish communal organizations, almost down to the synagogues, the grassroots levels, straight up to the very top. And so this is why they get to say the Israel lobby, I mean, even to say that there is an Israel lobby is considered anti-Semitic by some of these guys, because so many of these groups are charities that describe themselves as religious organizations. And for them to be Jewish is to be Zionist. They are procedurally in lockstep with Israel's sitting government. If there was a bit more of a moderate government, and you forget the current state of the Israeli opposition, then there would be a more moderate Israel lobby in Australia. You know, of course, Zionism is still necessarily a genocidal ideology, but there are ways to do it a bit more subtly than what's being done right now. And the large majority of Jewish organizations in Australia, they're incredibly structured, bureaucratic, interconnected, top-down style of leadership. And at the top, you get these federal peak-roof bodies, the Executive Council Australian Jewry and the Zionist Federation of Australia. So these groups have constituent organizations, they call them, which receive benefits in return for being constituents, including funding, representation, a seat at the table at, you know, the Council of Federation meetings. These constituent organizations will either have an objective relevant to Jews across Australia as well, or they are peak-roof bodies of a state like New South Wales. So underneath the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, ECACH for short, there's the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies. And underneath that, you get synagogues, community centers, Jewish day schools, these things. And you can think of this as almost like there's different levels of government, you know, federal, state, local governments. These all have, almost all of them, tax deductible status. Then you get these rogue groups that have popped up, especially recently. You get in 2017, there was the Australian Jewish Association, AJA. They really went to war with what you could call the establishment of the lobby, ECACH and ZFA, because they weren't loyal to them. They sat on the outside. They were blatantly far right. They were outside of the establishment's control. You could kind of think of this as like in 2016, when Trump came on stage at the Republican presidential debates, put two fingers up and said, you know, I'm running my own campaign. And of course, it was all ran by really billionaire donors still. But there's this facade of, you know, we're against the establishment. Back then, you had Mark Liebler, who runs the establishment of the lobby, calling out AJA for being racist and being close with fascists like Pauline Hanson. And in fact, Liebler hounded them out of community centres and got the centres who were hosting AJA events to get them to cancel those events. So what's changed now is because you have the most fascist government in Israeli history, and of course Israel's always been genocidal regardless, but you have the most fascist government, so now you have the most fascist Israel lobby in our history, because they're procedurally in lockstep with each other. It also allows these rogue groups like AJA to pop up on the fringe and drag it even further. Because when they say that they are representing what Israeli people really believe and taking that to Jewish Australians and lobbying on behalf of Jewish Australians, when they say that they are the only Jewish Australian community group with major representation that spits in the face of a two-state solution, they are actually telling the truth, because the establishment organizations will pay lip service to a two-state solution. And AJA doesn't play that game. And they're actually telling the truth when they say, we're the real guys representing what Israelis want, what Jewish Australians want, because they've all been dragged further and further to the right by the Bibi Netanyahu government. And just one last point, there's something really significant happening now as well, in that in November last year, the Zionist Federation of Australia apologized profusely to the Jewish community and acknowledged that they had actually failed to represent them on a grassroots level, that it was too much of a top-down style of leadership. And what they did was they amended their constitutional requirements to become a constituent organization so that it could open itself up to new constituents who were quote-unquote grassroots organizations. And a lot of these we saw pop up in the recent election as running campaigns, as explicitly political, telling people to put the Greens last. And a lot of these groups as well were really closely tied with the AJA.
I would like to delve deeper into these kind of intricacies as well as we progress in the conversation. But it's interesting that you say the lobby is also moved to the right as the Israeli government is moving to the right, because exactly the same phenomena is happening in the US, as Ilan Pappe's recent book explains. But Wendy, I really want to go to you in this about those organizations. You've written extensively about their behavior and their attitude towards government and media. So how has been their influence, the Israel lobbies group organizations' influence in government and media in general?
I'd just like to touch on something you said earlier about deaths in custody, because some of the things when we're talking about the media, some of the things we're talking about, some of the problems of the Australian media are problems for other issues too, not to in any way minimise the seriousness of what we're talking about now. And deaths in custody is an amazing example of that. I did a study actually after 30 years from the Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody of the media coverage of that issue during a period when the recommendations weren't implemented and deaths in custody continued until just this week, you know, with this horrific news. And in fact, there was almost no coverage. So silence is a major problem as well as vilification, stigmatizing people. The other side of that is silence. Now, just coming to the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby, look, I've been aware of that for an awfully long time. I guess even before 2000, like even going back before when many people watching this were born, you know, after 1975 in Australia, when it became clear that Gough Whitlam might have been tending the Labour Party to be more pro-Palestinian. That's really when, at a political level, the Zionist lobby began in the Labour Party. So there's a very, very long tail to this, and tail in both in story terms and in length of time. You know, I do agree with what I think it's very important to focus on this recent period and the developments that Yaakov is talking about. But Today, I was just having a look at Anthony Lowenstein, who published his book, and I knew Anthony before that. He's an Australian journalist, for those who, I think everybody, many people listening or watching will know, who's written a very important book called Palestinian Laboratory. Anthony was initially a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald when I first knew of him, and he left, you know, as far as I'm aware, because it was not possible to be questioning Israeli policies while you're a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. Now, there may have been other reasons, but he then went on to write a book called My Israeli Question in 2006, that was. So we're now talking about 20 years ago, when Michael Danby, who has played a very specific role in this election in the seat of McNamara, and we may come back to that, but he was a long-term Labor MP for Melbourne Ports. Now, he was one of those who is still active, but he entered the Labor Party, I think probably with a very big part of his mission was to advance Israel's interests. And, you know, when Anthony published his book, he attacked Melbourne University Press and said, how could you publish this completely fringe, terrible person? How could you even publish a book by him? And at the time, Anthony talked about how anti-Semitism, like back then, that whole idea of the self-hating Jew, and some people like Peter Slezak and others have been experiencing this for decades, but that was really a form of weaponizing anti-Semitism. But at the time, Anthony talked about that it was a way to silence dissent on the Jewish state, on the state of Israel. And, you know, knowing ABC correspondents, as I did in the Middle East, you know, you did hear how language was censored and you couldn't use certain words. So, you know, we've come to a really extreme point, I think, in this recent election and over the last year or two, but it has been a long process. I think there's various aspects to the influence on the media. But I also think that we need to see it in the context of an Islamophobic media. Now, over those decades, you know, we go back to the 1990s, say, or ever since then, but there's a huge amount of research and documentation done to demonstrate. When I was teaching at UTS, I had many students who would do case studies on this and just look at the way Islamophobia infused the media. Now, as well as that, you had the Zionist lobby influencing particular journalists and keeping the narrative going in a certain direction. And recently I attended a seminar or a forum, an amnesty forum, with Noor Hagar, Antoinette Latouf, and Jan Fran. And they're three now, not young, but I knew them when they were younger, coming out of the western suburbs of Sydney with a whole critique of the media, with an understanding that they came, in a sense, from the margins. And I heard them articulate this the other night, that journey of journalism, and it's no accident now. And I think we need to also, when we look at the problems with the media and their lack of serious coverage of Gaza, and we can talk about the ABC in relation to that, but there has been an engagement, if you like, that the mainstream or legacy media, as it's now often called, have not got the game completely sewn up. You know, there's a real counter to that coming from even people like yourself, Yaakov, all of those journalists, the work that Anthony has done. We are really not prepared to accept it anymore, that there will be this sanitized account of what is happening. I could obviously go into more specific examples, but I hope that sets some of the scene that I think we have to remember, some of the factors we have to remember when we're looking at it. And you know, the Islamophobia exists in all different sorts of ways. If we look at the video that was taken down by the ABC that Media Watch covered this week, a straight out interview, and it was removed. So you can have straight out acts of censorship like that, and whether they want to call it that or not, I would call it that. Or you can have just silencing and people in the background, who are writing pieces, for example, for the ABC, have to negotiate phrase by phrase what can be published or not published. So this media control takes all sorts of forms.
So the media coverage is almost the same, even probably worse.
Again, I think it's really hard to say worse, but I think that act of getting rid of Antoinette from the ABC absolutely shocked. And one thing I would like to say about that, that was brought about by the pro-Israeli lobby, by the Zionist lobby. And in fact, what they did was organize themselves into a great big WhatsApp group, more than one WhatsApp group actually, to lobby, to make those phone calls, to lay those complaints. You know, people were sort of shocked because it was exposed, because these days it is easier to expose things like that with social media, and WhatsApp groups can be penetrated and all that sort of thing. But really, that was sort of business as usual with a bit more intensity.
There's a lot to say about these things, like you mentioned, Wendy. There's so many examples. Yaakov, I want to go to you. We've been hearing a lot about the word hasbara. That's in Arabic, and then hasbara in English. And I think it means in Hebrew, public relations, something like that. Can you tell us what is hasbara, and how is this concept of hasbara seen and understood by the Jewish community? It feels as if it is a civic duty, kind of non-political really, but it's just an obligation kind of thing. Can you give us some insight into hasbara?
It's actually first I've heard that it's also an Arabic word. This shows how much I don't know really. You know, it is also a Hebrew word, which of course comes a lot, steals a lot of words from Arabic. It literally means to explain, but realistically it's to propagandize. There's a lot of talking points distributed from, you know, the Israeli embassy in Canberra, from the Israeli Ministry of Combating Anti-Semitism and Diaspora Affairs. Yes, that's a real cabinet ministry over there. It's a civic duty, they think of it. As Jews, we have anti-Semites. It's a necessary, just inherent part of the Jewish experience. There's always going to be people who are, you know, coming out for our blood. That's the narrative, at least. Because the narrative says, well, Israel defends all Jews against anti-Semitism, therefore it's every Jew's duty to defend Israel. Of course, the Zionist dream is to make Aliyah and immigrate over there, but if a Jew is living in the diaspora and they're not a perfect Zionist, then at least what they're required to do is to take up the civic duty to fight in the political spaces and the media where it says, you know, anti-Semitism has taken over. Even though you are required to go and be active in political spaces and in media to explain Israel's perspective, this isn't really seen as a political action. It's seen as, you know, common decency, as human rights. You're supporting Jews' right to national self-determination and to have a Jewish state. And it's presented as anti-racism. And so a lot of these Israel lobby groups, which describe themselves as Jewish communal groups, you know, we're talking even synagogues and day schools, will have what's called anti-Semitism training, which is how to explain to someone, if you run into them, if, you know, you happen to leave Bondi and you encounter an anti-Semite, this is how you explain to someone why Jews deserve a Jewish state, why Zionism is a common sense approach, why it's our human right to have a Jewish ethno-state. These kids who are being taught this don't even realize that they're being indoctrinated by political ideology.
This is interesting because I read Herzl's diaries. When he was asked how do you define a Jew, and the way he described it, he said a Jew is whoever anti-Semites hate. As for a Zionist, they are allowing anti-Semites to define what a Jew is. So to me, it's just a twisted way of looking at things.
Well, just in terms of what Yakov was just saying about, you know, how people come to believe these things. And obviously there is a process, an educational or indoctrination type process. And I was struck by that, and we're going to come back to that probably, but I was struck by that when I was covering the recent election campaign and went out to Wentworth, where Better Australia was campaigning, which is a Zionist group, which we might come back to. But it was very, very much campaigning against Allegra Spender. And I talked to some of the people who've been recruited volunteers, and one young Israeli woman said to me that her sister she was staying with had asked her to do it. And, you know, Allegra Spender was really very seriously anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. And, you know, there was no way that she was going to be persuaded otherwise. So I think it becomes very deeply embedded in a frame in which you interpret the world. But, you know, I think also for me, when I'm sort of looking at the media strategies, I've become interested in investigating, but it's much more serious than just an investigation, the impact of it. But things like, for example, that narrative that happened after October the 7th, very quickly, that narrative was put out about beheading of babies, that Hamas had beheaded babies. Now, that turned out, you know, and even Biden, I think, said he'd seen photos. And so that turned out not to be true. And similar to in a similar way, some of the allegations about rape. Now, I'm not saying that no rapes have happened on the part of Palestinian fighters. I'm not saying that. I'm not in a position to say that. But what I do know was that there was not the wholesale pack rape, because the New York Times put out that article and it was deconstructed by journalists, I think, at The Intercept. Really seriously good journalism unpacked and exposed. By then, there was no telling a lot of people that that isn't true, because the amount of detail you've got to go into. So these narratives grab hold. In Australia, the gas the Jews, the falsified tape was another example of that. And if you can get a narrative going like that, and there is, I think, clearly a strategy behind that activity, then it's very hard, particularly with our media today, our mainstream media, which tends to be very superficial and just sort of put narratives, maybe not particularly those ones at the moment. But a good example of this was when Gillian Siegel was interviewed recently by the ABC breakfast show by Sally Sarah, who's a highly respected journalist, I've got to say. And Gillian Siegel, who's meant to be the envoy for anti-Semitism, or is the envoy, but a very serious player in the Zionist lobby from a long way back, she just absolutely defamed the Greens, described, you know, them as anti-Semitic without evidence for that. She no doubt believes it because she sees criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. And a lot of complaints have gone in about that. But Sally Sarah has so far been defended by the ABC by saying it was a live interview. Now, she's a very experienced interviewer. I think this pressure that builds up from the Zionist lobby actually intimidates journalists and makes them ultra careful and not do the things that they would normally do, like pull someone up and question them.
And you've been listening to the first part of an online conversation between Amit Alabadli, Wendy Bacon, and Yaakov Aharon. And part two on the program next week.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying there is going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
The 2025 Sydney Peace Prize has been awarded to UN High Commission Judge Navi Pillay. And before we talk about why she's been chosen, Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees will explain when and why the Sydney Peace Prize was first awarded. And Stuart, it was back in 1998. What was happening at that time? Who were those involved in setting up the Sydney Peace Foundation?
Well, it began because in a conversation in the pub with a friend, I observed that Australia kept giving awards for sport, a major religion, and that seemed to be a bit odd. They had these wonderful dinners for cricketers and for rugby league players and AFL players and so on. And yet it seemed to me that the most precious commodity in the world, namely peace, was not recognized and certainly not rewarded. So the resolve to do something about that was really how it started.
And who was your collaborators at that time?
There was a couple of them. There was a guy called Ken McNabb. He was a trade unionist. He was a colleague of mine. He was from the history department at Sydney Uni. I think it was over a schooner of, I shouldn't do advertisements on your program, of Tui's New, we had that conversation. And then a few other people. There was a young man who had just come back from Bangladesh and who knew Muhammad Yunus. There were issues like that cropped up in the conversation. That's how we went about it. The other thing to say is that I had a chat with Kerry O'Brien, who at that time was the big ABC anchor for the 7:30 report, and we agreed to hold a meeting at a hotel in downtown Sydney along with a bunch of corporate high flyers to persuade them that the creation of a peace prize was a good idea. So there was a lot of politicking going on.
So they all agreed in the end?
He chaired the meeting, I remember, and some corporate high flyers put on a splendid lunch. The lunch didn't really have anything to do with justice or peace, but it attracted a certain influential audience.
And what was your criteria for the prize back then?
They were the same as now. I'd gone away and written three criteria. One was that there had to be a commitment to universal human rights. Not, in other words, it wasn't to be a prize for local initiatives. Secondly, that it was a commitment, evidence of a commitment to the language and practice of non-violence. The third was about an enthusiasm for all the details of the Charter of the United Nations.
What did Muhammad Yunus say to you when you said, well, we're going to offer you the Sydney Peace Prize?
He was enthusiastic. I mean, in those days, my practice was always to send letters of invitation by registered mail. So that once the jury had said, look, we're going to choose Muhammad Yunus, the creator of the Grameen Bank, he responded pretty quickly to what he described as a generous offer. In those days, the Peace Prize was worth $20,000 only. It's now $50,000. So it was after that first year, I think it became $50,000. Although money certainly wasn't a criteria for somebody who'd written books about poverty.
And what was the Grameen Bank at that time?
Well, the Grameen Bank was the first initiative ever to introduce what was called microcredit, to enable women to receive loans to develop projects, initiatives to get themselves out of poverty. I mean, previously, women had been largely disqualified from ever approaching a bank, let alone obtaining a loan, in particular in very poor countries like Bangladesh. And Muhammad Yunus had come back from doing a PhD at a prestigious American university, a PhD in economics, and he told me that all the textbooks on economics had nothing to say about the relief of poverty. And that's what motivated him to create the Grameen Bank. It's really what motivated us to ensure that he was the first, he was the inaugural recipient of the Peace Prize.
Well, we're going to talk about Navi Pillay soon, and there's a lot to say about her work. Some of the other you've had over those, nearly 30 years now.
Yeah, nearly 30 years. Well, they were all giants in a way. I mean, he was followed by the inimitable Archbishop Tutu, Desmond Tutu. That was an unforgettable occasion because he came at a time when the Prime Minister of Australia was refusing to say sorry to Indigenous people. And one of Tutu's themes was that it takes a big brave person to say sorry to anybody for anything. He was one giant. I mean, Sir William Dean, the governor, the very principled, visionary Governor General of Australia, was another. Patrick Dodson received the prize from Prime Minister Kevin Rudd at that time. Mary Robinson, 2002, was a former President of Ireland, but a High Commissioner for Human Rights. Janana Guzma, a poet, a guerrilla leader, and then, of course, the first significant leader of Timor-Leste. I remember him very clearly. And then you've got perhaps the most memorable and the most significant was the award to Noam Chomsky, the wonderful American linguist, academic, human rights activist. We could have filled the Sydney Opera House every night of a week when Chomsky came.
Have you heard how he is lately?
Well, no, I haven't. I know he's had a stroke. His voice is silenced, but apparently not his pen, as far as I can make out, because I've seen reports of a new publication of Chomsky. I mean, the guy, he must be about 93 or 94 now, and he never stops. It'll be an enormous loss when we have to write his obituary.
Well, you've picked a good one this year, Stuart, the United Nations High Commissioner, Judge Navi Pillay. She's got a pretty extensive career,
record,
hasn't she?
Yeah. I mean, and she comes at a time when the covenant of the United Nations is being ignored by governments. Comes at a time when violence in Sudan and Gaza and the West Bank and Ukraine and Myanmar seems to be the only way that men in and out of uniform are able to think. So yeah, no, Navi, and her record is really as a woman of colour from apartheid South Africa has shown by bravery, by certain charismatic charm, as well as by her legal knowledge and skills, has achieved significant victories. She's, if you like, in the jargon, she's broken the glass ceilings so many times. I mean, if we look at her record.
And it began in South Africa as a first non-white woman lawyer.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Look, I mean, the South African example is important because I remember Mandela in personal conversation saying to me, as he had said to others, that South Africa will never be free until Palestine is free. That has a particular resonance, and I'm sure Navi Pillay, when she comes to Sydney in November, is going to repeat that principle.
What work has she done over the years for the UN?
She was appointed the judge to supervise the UN's inquiry into the genocide in Rwanda. She more recently is the UN's appointee to conduct inquiries into sexual and gender-based violence by Israeli forces in Gaza. No, she's been an incredibly principled and brave standard bearer in all those positions.
And what position does she hold at the moment?
She's still the Commissioner for Human Rights, but most important of all, she's the judge in charge of the UN's Commission of Inquiry into sexual and gender violence in Gaza and the West Bank.
Who were the members of the jury who chose her this year?
Okay, good question. Well, I'm no longer on the jury. I haven't been for years. And we don't or the Peace Foundation doesn't publish their names. I mean, I could take a few guesses. I imagine that it was chaired by Melanie Morrison, who's the impressive new director of the Peace Foundation. That's all I know. I'm a sort of slightly wise elder whom they consult occasionally. The University of Sydney has a very checkered career.
Yes.
All the time I was a member of the Senate of the University and a professor of social policy and social work, then we had a base. We had connections across different faculties. We certainly had enthusiastic support from students. When I resigned, God knows how many years ago, that made it more difficult for the young women who succeeded me as director of the Peace Foundation. They did a very good job. But the university, frankly, was not as supportive as it could have been. When I say the university, these were usually self-important deans of faculties, particularly deans of arts and social sciences, who weren't interested in peace with justice. Somehow they didn't see it as an academic subject. And now, of course, the university has decided that they don't want the Peace Foundation located at the university anymore. They do not want it to be a foundation of the university. So they've given instructions that it should go and leave the university and find another home. I'm actually going, let me see, next week to have a face-to-face encounter with the Vice Chancellor.
Like to be a fly on the wall?
You would like to be a fly on the wall. I'm probably not allowed to publish what happens.
And what about the Lord Mayor of Sydney? How did that come about?
Oh, well, the Lord Mayor of Sydney at the time was Frank Sartor, who was a very controversial Labour politician. But he was a gutsy sort of guy, and he and I got on well. We both had a kind of knockabout attitude to life. I respected him, he respected me, and at a ceremony in the VIP lounge in the town hall, we signed a contract that the City of Sydney would be our patron. And since then, Lord Mayor Clover Moore has maintained that support. She has been brave, principled, crucial. Of course, the right-wing forces used to be called the Liberal Party, I think. They're desperately keen to get rid of Clover Moore, but she is continually re-elected, and so she remains the very significant patron of the Peace Prize.
Now, Thursday, the 6th of November, is the big day?
Yeah, that's when Judge Pillay will give the Sydney Peace Prize lecture in the town hall, and the night before she'll be honoured at a special dinner at the University of Sydney.
Well, Stuart, you've got to make sure that you record her speech.
Oh yeah, no, it'll be recorded and distributed, and I'm sure the media will be hungry for interviews with her. It'll be a bit strange for the media to suddenly become enthusiastic about somebody who's an advocate of universal human rights.
Yes.
You're an exception to the rule.
Okay, Stuart, well done, and back to you, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. Lovely to talk to you, Jan. You have a good one.
And I've been speaking with Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees.
Did you know that each donation over $2 you make to 3CR's Radiothon is tax deductible? That means that when you're doing your tax return business, you can claim your 3CR donation as a legitimate tax deduction. To make a pledge to this year's Radiothon, call the station on 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au/donate. Your station, your voice.
And welcome once again to Journalists with Orange Business, Nick McClellan. And the topic today, Nick, is the third UN conference on the oceans being held in France, described as a global call to save our blue heart. The first one was in 2017 in New York, the second in Lisbon in 2022. What were their aims and what do you believe they achieved?
One of the major shifts in recent years is to get governments, communities, international organisations to look at the multifaceted way that oceans affect people's lives. Where I work in the Pacific Islands, this is fundamentally important because the vast Pacific, which makes up a third of the surface of the planet, is seen as connecting peoples. You know, often people of the Northern Hemisphere saw oceans dividing, but in many ways, Pacific peoples believe that oceans connect and that indeed the land, the water, the stars above are part of a whole. And just as with Indigenous peoples, saltwater peoples in Australia, in Arnhem Land, in the Torres Strait, there's a recognition of the ocean as a source of life. Now, that source of life is under threat from capitalism, from international trade, from pollution, particularly plastic pollution, the threat of deep sea mining and deep sea oil and gas exploration as the onshore and offshore, close offshore sources of fossil fuels are being exploited. Companies are going deeper and deeper into the ocean to draw out remaining oil and gas reserves. And so the plunder of the oceans, fisheries, deep sea minerals, oil and gas, even the very life forms of the ocean, on the reef ecology of fisheries and so on, that are pharmaceutical companies trying to patent them. There's enormous challenges to the ocean health and the sustainability that it provides, particularly for Indigenous peoples who live off ocean bounty. So these conferences are an attempt to try and get some regulation of the oceans, which are obviously, the common heritage of humanity, but have an importance for particularly coastal peoples that cannot be undervalued.
Well, have they achieved any of that in those last two conferences?
There's been significant steps forward, and indeed our neighbouring countries in the Pacific have been at the forefront of some of the more innovative steps. Years ago, the United Nations had what they called Millennium Development Goals that were set in 2000 to address poverty, to address violence against women. These were ambitious global targets to reduce poverty, to address women's rights, girls' rights, to address environmental challenges. When those were updated in 2015, Pacific Island countries, together with other members of the Alliance of Small Island States, you know, countries from the Indian Ocean, Caribbean, and so on, fought for a special goal on the ocean. They never had one in the UN, and this was an attempt to broaden the history around the UN Conference of the Law of the Sea, which was first signed in the early 80s, but has lots of gaps, 40 years old. And so there's been a big push since 2015 to strengthen global action on the oceans and seas. The first UN envoy on the ocean, appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations, was Fiji's former ambassador to the UN. And so small island states, it's hardly surprising when they're surrounded by ocean, have been in the forefront of trying to push this. And you see it manifested in many ways. There's a real push, for example, for a global treaty on plastic production. You only have to look at the pictures of seabirds swallowing bits of plastic that are just swept into the ocean. The incredible plastic waste that's generated by modern capitalism, rather than trying to pick up all the bits out of the ocean, why not address it at the source? And many countries are now trying to ban single-use plastics. But that needs global action, otherwise people relocate production around the world. There's another major treaty, and this has been a step forward, about protecting marine biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. It's a treaty called BBNJ in shorthand. It's got a very long, wordy title. But the basic concept is that under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, an international agreement signed in 1982, countries got to regulate areas of 200 nautical miles around all their land, their reefs, their islands. And so countries have what's called an exclusive economic zone. And these can be big. French Polynesia, for example, which is five archipelagos scattered across a vast area, has an exclusive economic zone of 5 million square kilometres. Kiribati, which is a series of tiny dots spread across the ocean in terms of a land area, only about 380 square kilometres of land, has 3.5 million square kilometres of ocean under its management. And the EEZ gives you the right to control ocean resources, to manage the environment, to control fisheries from distant water fishing nations and so on. So it's an incredible step forward. BBNJ, as the name suggests, is moving to protect biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. So in all the pockets of ocean outside the existing law of the sea. A treaty was adopted in 2023. It needs 60 countries to ratify it in order to enter into force legally internationally. And just this week, 18 more countries have signed on. So they're 50 out of 60 countries required have now ratified. They hope some governments by the end of the year to get the 60. And so countries like Fiji, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, at last week's Oceans Conference in France, all lodged their formal ratifications. First country in the world to ratify it was Palau, the Micronesian nation. This, once again, is a vital step. And what's striking is it comes at a time that the Americans are trying to destroy this system. Donald Trump announced that he was going to remove regulation of fisheries and other marine operations in waters around U.S. territories in the Pacific. And that includes CNMI, Guam, American Samoa, and so on, and to let free rein in these international waters that don't come under national jurisdiction. So there's a battle going on, a battle for control of the oceans, battle for control of ocean resources, as countries try and diversify their supply chains of crucial minerals. The deep seas are becoming the new frontier for international competition. And although it sounds pretty abstract in day by day, this diplomacy at these UN conferences is an attempt to say that the oceans belong to everyone. They're the heritage of humanity. We need to protect them.
With these exclusive economic zones, is there also an issue of how countries use those zones, the power they have?
There's significant debates about those. Within the Pacific, there's quite a lot of division amongst Pacific Island states over the potential for deep sea mining. The vast majority of members of the Pacific Islands Forum have called for a moratorium, and some indeed a full ban on deep sea mining within their EEZ, their exclusive economic zone. New Caledonia, for example, earlier this year announced a 50-year moratorium on deep sea oil and gas exploration and so on within their EEZ. But there are a few countries, notably Nauru, Cook Islands, Tonga to a certain extent, that are considering working with transnational corporations to allow deep sea mining to go ahead within their waters. Nauru and Cooks are amongst the smallest, less than 20,000 people, and the poorest, relatively, countries, Nauru particularly, in the region. They don't have a lot of other things to deal with. Nauru was mined out its phosphate resources by Australia, New Zealand and Britain during colonial times. Nauru's been desperately seeking money through shonky businesses like hosting Australia's detention centres for offshore refugee processing. And so they argue that they should be allowed to work with transnational corporations, like a company known as the Metals Company, in order to exploit their deep sea resources. And that's a battle being played out in the Pacific. And this same battle's being played out around fisheries, deep sea resources, and around the patenting of life forms. There's incredible genetic diversity within the deep ocean. And there's a lot of interest from pharmaceutical companies and intellectual property organizations in the Northern Hemisphere to patent life forms, which is, I would argue, a crime against humanity, but is a growing trend in international science. So these are all areas of constraint. And what's striking is that many Pacific countries, not all, but most, are at the forefront of fighting against the privatization of the oceans for the benefit of the few.
It's also a fact, Nick, that most things that are in those deep seas aren't even categorized yet.
Absolutely. You know, the science of the deep ocean is really lacking, and it's sort of one area. We know a lot more about the sky and outer space than we do about the deep ocean. And that's where there's many countries who are calling for a moratorium on the exploitation of deep sea resources, basing it on the precautionary principle that until we know what's there, we shouldn't damage it. The oceans, however, are being damaged in a variety of ways, the most obvious of which is climate change. I won't go into the science, but people will know that warming oceans, heating oceans, are affected by ocean acidification. As CO2 is absorbed into the oceans, they become a carbon sink. But the CO2 impact will affect reef ecologies, and we see mass coral bleaching, the death of reef ecologies, and so on. And so there's a huge fight, and Pacific countries, once again, are at the forefront of making the connection between oceans, climate, and biodiversity and sustainability. Governments like Vanuatu and others that are at the forefront of this fight say we have to make the connection between ocean protection, between climate action, and between protecting biodiversity for all of humanity.
And also the rising sea levels are impacting on the low-level countries around the world, particularly around the Pacific. I can imagine that they're losing a lot of their land and a lot of their arable land because of sea salt.
Absolutely. You know, agriculture and water supply are badly affected on many islands. Greenpeace and others have popularised the notion of people going glug, glug, glug under the waves in the future. The problems are now. The problems are that with storm surges and floods crossing the land, that creates problems for agriculture. It destroys sustainable agriculture. And Australians should understand this. Look at what's happened in Taree in recent months. What's happened to Lismore two or three times over the last 5 years. I mean, this is a global problem. This is not a Pacific problem, that climate change creates extreme weather events, storm surges, floods, changing water patterns, more intense cyclones. The science is there, despite the fossil fuel industry trying to deny the reality. And that's why Pacific governments are currently so angry at the Albanese government. They talk the talk about climate action, and yet the first major action of the re-elected Albanese government is to approve an extension provisionally of operations on Northwest Shelf by the giant corporation Woodside out to 2070. Talking about net zero by 2050, they've added another 45 years of operations for the massive gas and LNG processing that goes on at Karratha and Northwest Shelf, possibly opening the way into the Browse Basin as well. Woodside wants to build a pipeline into another gas field. The Albanese government talks through its arse when it says we're a partner in the Pacific when it comes to the refusal to address the expansion of oil, gas and coal operations. And not just production, but exports. You know, 80% of West Australian gas goes overseas, particularly to Japan. And Japanese companies are investing massively in Western Australian gas. So when the Albanese government says, oh, you know, we need this as a transitional fuel to help reduce prices for East Coast consumers, it's bullshit. Most of our gas is exported overseas in long-term contracts to countries like Japan. And that's a real blow in terms of international climate negotiations, because you count the energy that you burn, the CO2 generated by energy consumption within your country, but you don't count what's exported to another country. So Australia, being one of the world's largest fossil fuel exporters of oil, of gas, of coal, doesn't get to count those exports as part of their nationally contribution to climate action. So there's an anger about Australia's climate hypocrisy that runs pretty deep among some neighbouring countries.
And what is known about the impacts on the marine life of these gas projects?
Well, there's enormous impacts both in the ocean and on land. Proposal to build a pipeline from the Browse Basin, which is northwest of Broome, to link up with the current Woodside gas processing plant at Karratha, which basically creates LNG, liquefied natural gas, for export from the gas fields of the Northwest Shelf, running that pipeline out to the Browse Basin, you know, to tap a whole other gas field, will cause enormous damage to marine ecology, to dugongs. There's a whole lot of scientific studies and a lot of scientific debate about this whole question. This also affects Indigenous communities in a variety of ways. One of the big battlegrounds that tried to delay the approval of an extension to Woodside's operations on Northwest Shelf was protection of engravings. Incredible rock art that you find in the Pilbara, particularly near the Karratha sites. There's a lot of concern that the pollution coming from LNG production is, over time, damaging this historic cultural treasure. You know, these rock carvings are estimated to be more than 40,000 years old. There's a lot of scientific studies about the incredible cultural value they hold for people, Indigenous peoples in the Pilbara. 40,000 years old, that's 8 times older than the pyramids of Giza. And the pyramids of Giza are listed as World Heritage. There's an attempt to get UNESCO World Heritage listing for these rock art. And yet the Albanese government has gone ahead to expand production until 2070, despite this cultural heritage that should be celebrated around the world, but isn't celebrated. The very fact that Woodside pays remarkably little tax on shipping gas offshore to Japan is a sign of the failure of the government to take on the mining industry and address these fundamental questions.
Do these conferences take any notice of changes in shipping around the world? And I'm thinking what used to be an issue a few years ago was the burning of the dirty oil in these ships, and they tried to stop that. Did they end up stopping them doing that?
It's a battle that's still going on. The International Maritime Organization is the UN-affiliated global body for, as the name suggests, maritime and shipping issues. For a number of years, as you say, there's been a push to start putting levies on bunker fuel.
That's it.
So the bunker fuel is this heavy, viscose oil that is used for international shipping. It's incredibly polluting, generates a whole lot of methane, and generates a whole lot of CO2. And there's a need to transition to more sustainable and renewable transport fuels. The Solomon Islands and Marshall Islands, amongst many other smaller countries, have been at the forefront of pushing for this transition. And partly that's out of self-interest. A number of Pacific countries have what's called flag of convenience shipping. So say the Marshall Islands rents out its flag, Tonga and others, to international shipping fleets. So they benefit from international shipping. And obviously countries that are quite isolated from major centres of development, they rely on shipping for trade. So they have an interest in keeping the shipping industry viable. And so Marshall's and Solomon Islands ambassadors have been pushing for a levy on the use of bunker fuel as a way of raising the price of using these toxic fuels and getting people to do the work to transition towards cheaper, more sustainable and greener shipping fuels. There was a major meeting earlier this year. People were quite disappointed that there's resistance from, surprise, surprise, big countries to pay the price of this. And this is a battle about all of these processes, whether we're talking about climate or oceans or shipping. Capitalism relies on the oceans as transport routes, as sea lanes of communication to move production around the world. And, you know, you see at moments when Donald Trump comes in and talks about decoupling from China, or when the Houthis block shipping through the Red Sea, it raises the cost of production for trade. And so this is a battleground about who controls the oceans. More and more small island states are joining with other developing countries to argue that these are common heritage and that wealthy countries have to pay to address this. It's the same discussion about climate finance. The environment movement in Australia really talks about climate finance, yet it's a central pillar of the global climate negotiations every year, the so-called COPs, the Conference of the Parties. Yes, there's a major focus on emissions reduction, reducing the generation of CO2, but climate finance, helping poor countries make the transition from polluting fuels to renewable energy, just as Australia's trying to do, slowly, very slowly, someone's got to pay for it. And that's the battleground. OECD countries don't want to pay for it. Australia gets all its climate finance from the aid budget, the Overseas Development Assistance budget. And it's only common sense, if you give more climate finance from one budget, you're taking it away from other areas, be it health, be it education, be it women's rights, be it environmental action and so on. Australia's current budget says our aid, ODA, Official Development Assistance, will basically flatline till 2036. So for another decade, our aid won't go down, except a small percent in real terms because of inflation, but it won't go up. Now, that's just crazy. There are demands for resources across the world to address oceans, to address climate action, to address biodiversity. And Australia is going to need to find some innovative resources, innovative sources of funding to address these demands from our closest neighbours in Asia and in the Pacific. And it's not rocket science. There are areas where action could be taken. We give billions of dollars every year in subsidies to fossil fuel. How about cutting some of those and rediverting them towards climate action? We give billions of dollars in tax dodges to wealthy corporations who are exporting gas offshore. How about fighting the fight over the resource rental tax to actually get some money out of it? We actually are about to be jammed by the Trump administration, who want us not just to pay $4 billion towards fixing their shipyards, but probably doubling that. You know, the AUKUS crisis, you know, that faces the Australian government is a hand grenade waiting to explode, because the Trump administration, in its transactional relationship with allies, is going to put the screws on Australia to spend more on defence. And yet our greatest security is addressing the environmental and social challenges in the neighbours around us.
Well, just to focus on the third conference, Nick, it's been held in Nice in France, finished on the 13th of June. Challenges, problems we've talked about. Where is it going, the conference? Are they focusing on all those things, or are they being distracted by other things?
Like all these global conferences, there are compromises. And, you know, everyone's got one vote. It's like the UN General Assembly. But obviously some countries are more powerful than others. You know, the countries that are at the forefront of many of these questions, as we mentioned, small island states that face the climate emergency at the frontier, have a moral voice, but they don't have much economic and in some ways political clout. But they use what they have incredibly powerfully. And that's where we've seen years ago, people laughed at the notion that there should be a treaty not just covering national jurisdictions, but the high seas. The argument was, how could we ever regulate the high seas? You know, who's going to do that? Well, this treaty sets out a mechanism, however flawed, towards that goal. And that's an amazing step forward in a relatively short time. 18 more countries signed up on the 9th of June to formally ratify the treaty. We're 50 out of 60 countries before it entered into force. And that's an enormous step forward. On the climate front, people we've talked about before on the program, Vanuatu successfully led a campaign before the UN General Assembly to get the United Nations to ask the International Court of Justice, the highest court in the world, for an advisory opinion on climate change and human rights and the obligations of states. We know that most of the pledges made at the annual COP are voluntary. The so-called nationally determined contributions are determined nationally. Like, there's no law that says you have to act on climate change. And Donald Trump's just walked away, as we've seen. Countries are pushing through international law and the ICJ. They want an advisory opinion that says climate change is bad for you and states have obligations to act on the adverse effects of climate change. That's a non-binding advisory opinion, but has huge weight in international law as a step forward. It's a building block towards domestic litigation. And so you'd have a situation where, you know, the highest court in the world will have said that states have obligations around ending climate pollution and reparations for those affected by adverse. That's a major legal shift that would have obvious relevance to the fight of indigenous people to protect their rock art against Woodside. These are building blocks. They're not the solution. They're not quick. But Pacific Island countries are not sitting saying, oh, woe is us. They're at the forefront of these battles. Just a few weeks ago, 8 Pacific Island countries put forward a resolution to the World Health Assembly. This is the regular meeting of the World Health Organization, Global Health Network. And for the first time in more than 30 years, the WHO will pick up a mandate again to address the link between health and nuclear weapons. They've set up a panel initiated by this resolution from Pacific Island countries to do a study on how nuclear weapons and nuclear warfare affect human health. It's not exactly rocket science, but countries like France and Britain voted against this at the World Health Assembly, alongside, guess who, Russia and North Korea. These are the nuclear weapons club stick together against an attempt to reduce nuclear arsenals. And it's striking, once again, that the small island states at the ICJ, at the World Health Assembly, at the International Maritime Organization, are fighting the fight to advance these sort of agendas. And that's backed by community and church and civil society groups who often put these ideas forward in the first place. And they've been slowly but steadily picked up by governments to implement. And that's where people in Australia don't understand that, the Albanese government wants to host COP31, UN Framework on Climate Change, a conference of the parties. That'll be in 2026. We'll know within the next few weeks whether Australia has won the bid against Turkey. And if they do, gear up, because a lot of civil society networks, environment groups, trade unions and others are going to be giving hell to the Albanese government over the next year because of its climate hypocrisy. It says it wants to act on climate, and yet it's still expanding and extending exports of fossil fuels. And that battleground will be between June this year at the next Bonn conference of the Climate Network and COP31, which they're hoping to host in Adelaide, Penny Wong territory, in 2026.
And, of course, the Pacific Forum meeting, where a lot of these issues will be discussed.
All this is on the table in September, first week of September, in Honiara, the Solomon Islands. This year, the Solomons is hosting. It's going to be a bit of a messy conference because China-Taiwan battle will be fought out once again, taking time away from staff from these crucial questions about the oceans and so on. There's some major declarations coming up. There's been a so-called review of regional architecture, looking at how the forum relates to the vast diversity of countries that want to engage with the Pacific Islands at the moment. That'll be a major, it sounds bureaucratic, but it's quite important in terms of dealing with, there are currently 21 countries that have dialogue status with the forum. There's another 6 or 8 who want to join, including Israel, Ukraine, Saudi Arabia. So global pressures are coming on this small regional organisation. There's also a discussion about what's called the Ocean of Peace. Prime Minister Rumbuka of Fiji put forward this concept, and there's been a battle behind the scenes about what do you mean by peace? Can you have peace without justice? Can you have peace in a region that still has colonies? And as we saw with the clashes in New Caledonia last year, it's a very unpeaceful situation. You can hear Australia now saying we support peace through deterrence and nuclear submarines. That's not going to go down well with many Pacific groups. But so there's plenty of battles to come in September. I'll be there as a journalist. There's a lot happening in the world, but it's really important to say that our Pacific neighbours are often at the forefront of thinking about innovative solutions to global problems. So whether that's around the oceans in France, whether that's around the International Maritime Organization, bunker fuel debate, whether it's at the World Health Assembly looking at the connection between nuclear weapons and health, people are not sitting back. People are out there fighting, and it sets a good example that could be followed by our government if they had more gumption.
I thank you once again, Nick.
Thanks as always, Jan. Look forward to speaking soon.
And for more of the work of journalist Nick McClellan, have a look at Islands Business online, the journal where he works. And more wonderful donations to our Radiothon for 2025. Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, Wayne Wright, Neil Blake, Ian McIntyre, Barbara Hall, Peter Wooten, Marie Delora, Romina Beetson, Claire Sanders, Karina Adair, David Spratt, Marin Chincotta, Edward Ford, and John Gillies. And many, many thanks to all those lovely people. But it's not too late, you know, if you still haven't pledged your support for this radio station. We need every cent we can get because we run on a shoestring, but there's still cost to pay. So please, if you can, please donate to 3CR. You can ring 039 419 8377 or get onto the web, 3cr.org.au. It's all tax deductible. A receipt will be forwarded on to you. So please, if you haven't donated yet, we've still got a way to go, 9419 8377, anytime during office hours. And again, thank you so much for everyone who's contributing to making sure that this wonderful little radio station, well, it's not so little anymore, but it stays on air. It'll be 50 years next year. Thank you.
3CR Radiothon 2025. Your station, your voice.
To donate, call 03 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au.
On the program last week, John Lander spoke in part about the contradictions of Australia serving as a proxy for US war with China and China's position as Australia's main trading partner. Today's social commentator and author John Quirrapel also looks at China, both the past and the present. So John, let's begin with a bit of history lesson for China. We're going back over 700 years, which resonates to today.
About the closing off of China. China was the massive civilization under the Tang and the Song dynasties. The economy of China was about 60% of the world. They were followed then by India. We tend to think the Western domination is the norm, but that's only been, say, for about the last 300 years. Before that, it was China and India were the great powers of the world. And, of course, we're returning to what is normal at the moment with Western decline and the rise of particularly China, but also India, which is about the fastest growing economy in the world, although it's coming off a lower base, of course, than China. But China had massive ships in the 15th century, and they sailed all the way to Africa and Arabia under the Yongle Emperor, or Xu Di. They sailed all that way under Zhang He, the admiral who took them. These ships were massive, 100 metres long, a huge berth. That about five times the size of the Portuguese caravels, which would follow them a century later and lead to the Western conquering of the world. But when they sailed out, they weren't interested in conquering. They took tribute, of course. That was a normal thing for an empire to do, but they brought the Chinese civilization with them, sought to show China's power and wealth, and established diplomatic and trade relations, but they never sought to conquer. This is the thing that people go on about now, that China wants to conquer. China's not interested in conquering and never has been, mainly because of some egotistical thing that they thought at that stage that they had the world. They were the middle kingdom. They had the world. The world had nothing to give to them. They weren't interested in conquering other places.
Can you explain the tributes?
The usual thing that empires took, some wealth, of course, some gifts. Later on, the British would try and give tribute to China, and the Chinese would reject it. It was a sort of thing that cemented relationships. Of course, the empire had relationships in its own favour, but they weren't grossly exploitative, as later on happened with the Western powers, which basically raped, plundered and pillaged the rest of the world. So these are massive ships. And then a new Chinese emperor came to the throne in 1424, Zhu Gaoxi, and he decided that he would not carry on the this policy, he turned inward. So the ships destroyed or they rotted away. So China turned inward, and that would be the disaster for China. And it really lasted, this turning inward, right up to the 50, 60 years ago. China had turned so inward, and it was Deng Xiaoping who decided finally to open to the world. Well, it was only 40 years ago, 1980s, that Deng Xiaoping decided to open again to the world. But China had closed itself off and became enfeebled and progressively became weaker and weaker until it was conquered by the Western powers, and particularly the British. I mean, British could conquer anything. When you think of it, a small nation like Britain in the end conquered both India and China, massive civilizations. They really were a power unto themselves. But China became this enfeebled nation. It's only recent times, of course, that we're getting the rise of China again.
Just talk about the Opium Wars, because that was disastrous for China, weren't they?
The Opium Wars were terrible. The Chinese Emperor requested Queen Victoria, please stop this policy of importing huge amounts of opium into China. The whole background, of course, to it was that the Chinese weren't taking anything from Britain. Lord Macartney had come out, he tried to offer the fruits of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, and the Chinese Emperor refused those things. As I say, the Chinese believed they had everything, disastrous policy. But when this happened, the Opium Wars were declared because China was taking all the British silver, because Britain were taking things from China, particularly tea. That's where our addiction in the British English speaking cultures to tea comes from. We're taking tea and other goods from China and receiving nothing in return. So they were paying the Chinese silver, so massive amounts of silver. So they had to create a demand for something in China that the Chinese would want, and they hit upon this idea of opium. So British Empire became the biggest runners of opium, the biggest drug lords in history. So they're running huge amounts of opium to China, and the Emperor, as I said, please stop doing that. And Queen Victoria refused to take any action. And so as the previous queen, been the biggest drug runner in the world, but that was the case. The Chinese in the end were tired of this. The Emperor ordered that the opium be destroyed. They threw the opium into the harbour, and the British responded because they needed that foreign exchange by declaring the Opium Wars. And China, being enfeebled, was overrun by a much smaller country. So in 1839, first Opium War happened. The British won. The Chinese had to cede ports and receive this opium. And opium addiction became huge in China. It even made us out here to the gold fields, of course, the opium and the gold fields. The Chinese became addicted to this. It was a terrible situation. But that still wasn't enough. The Chinese refused to cede any more ports, because one of the things they had to do was to cede ports to the British. So there was a second Opium War in 1860. And this time, concessions were made into China by the British, the French, the Russians, the Germans. These concessions were made, and these were exclusive sort of zones where money could be taken out of China. One of the things when the Chinese resisted that, the British and the French destroyed the Yuanmingyuan, which is the summer palace, the magnificent summer palace. They destroyed that, razed it to the ground. So this is the humiliation that the Chinese feel. Now, it is a very deep humiliation, and it's very real that they have this sense that it was a century of humiliation, you know, from 1840 to 1949 with the rise of the Communist Party, where Mao Zedong's first words to the first Congress of the Chinese Communist Party were that China has stood up. Well, in a sense they had, but they still turned inward, greatly poor. The Cultural Revolution was still turning inward. And you had to get up to 1978 with Deng Xiaoping, who finally opened the Chinese economy to the world and as I say, the rest is history. China is now the largest economy in the world by purchase power parity, which is what money can buy. It's been a massive change. But as they're returning to normal, China in the Song and in the Tang dynasties before that had 60% of the world, some may even put it higher, of the world economy was in China. So we're returning to normality.
Can I take you back to the opium in China? How did the authorities or the people recover from an addiction like that? I mean, they didn't have the resources that we might have here. How did they treat it?
It was absolute addiction. As I said, you get the stories here on the gold fields. I'm down visiting your part of the world now, and I was out at Ararat the other day in the wonderful museum there, and it's got some of the stories. And opium was a terrible problem on the gold fields out here with the Chinese. It was an absolute national addiction, and it really wasn't wiped out until the Communist Party came to power in 1949, no longer an issue. You don't see great amounts of drug addiction. I'm sure it is there, or it just is there in China today, but it's not a great addiction like we see in many parts of the world to different drugs.
Okay, well, bring us up to the present, John, with the US now in decline and Australia doesn't quite know what to do. It's hanging on to the coattails of the US like mad, but its major trade partner is China. US is pushing us to go to war with China. Where's it going to end?
Frightening stuff. Have a deputy prime minister here who I tend to think is... It makes me think of Dr. Strangelove. This idea of going to war with China, it's inane. China don't want war with us. There's this popular cultural thing that China want war with us because we've got resources. Well, they're trading the resources. Why would you want to go to war with a nation where you're getting the resources you want? Anyway, if China wanted to go to war over resources, they've got a nice place right next door called Mongolia. It's a massive land with 3 million people in it, huge amounts of resources. But the Chinese aren't interested in rolling into Mongolia. They're certainly not interested in saying to Indonesia, excuse us while we pass through, we're on our way to conquer Australia. This is absolutely off the wall sort of stuff. But the media push it. We know the red alert we had in the Age, the Sydney Morning Herald a couple of years ago. It's absolutely inane. It's unbelievable when you read about some respected or so-called respected commentators are saying this. But China, definitely not interested in it. We are the largest trading partner. Of course, the Chinese are supposed to be wanting to sink their own ships, which are bringing the things that they need from Australia back to China, and the Chinese are wanting to sink them. Therefore, we've got to have submarines to stop them doing that. Submarines, which we'll never get. That's becoming more and more accepted. It's a pipe dream, this whole AUKUS idea. It keeps going further and further off the planet, the scenarios and the ideas behind AUKUS. But it's starting to trip up now. The US are running their own inquiry into AUKUS with the America First idea of Trump, and it's never going to happen whether that inquiry decides to pull out of it. Australia can't pull out of it, by the way. We've already donated $800 million to the US, which is very nice of us, for shipbuilding. There's no way the US can build the ships that the submarines they're supposed to be able to build, and the idea that the British can build the next generation of submarines for AUKUS is just unbelievably off the planet. But this silly idea goes round. But the US, of course, are turning inward. This is the whole Trump thing. There's a lot of anger in the US because of what's happened. There's a denial of it, but underneath an acceptance that we are in decline. The US, when you think of it, in 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, if you said the US would not be the unipolar power or basically forever, you would have been laughed at. And yet here we are just 35 years later, and we've got China now, the biggest economy in the world, dominating in so many ways while the US sinks back. You look at Chinese infrastructure. It's incredible. 50,000 kilometers of high-speed rail built in 20 years. We're still waiting for that mythical one. Well, I'm from Newcastle, especially one going from Sydney to Newcastle, high-speed rail. And it's just around the corner, evidently, a long way around the corner. For one going from Sydney to Melbourne, that's pretty further around the corner. But China put 50,000 kilometres in 20 years. The massive ports that they've put in, the developments in computing that are now onto and moving ahead of the US and even in some of those specialities that the US have dominated in. The EVs, of course, electric vehicles, you go around China, they're green and blue number plates. Green, that's easy to pick, are the EVs, and there's all sorts of concessions given that you get those registrations for free, whereas you've got to pay a huge amount of registration for a petrol-powered internal combustion engine. You've got to pay a much higher fee to register those vehicles. In the US, they recognise this, and there's an anger. They deny it, but they recognise it, you know, that sort of psychological thing. And so Trump is the result. The swamp, as he likes to call it, has drained out the US. It's the policies of the Democrats in the US have been disastrous, and past Republicans. And so Trump has capitalized on that. There's a lot of anger, and Trump's our man, and Trump's going to fix things. But of course, that's just not going to happen. It's inevitable, the decline of the US in terms of foreign exchange, that's happening. The reserve currency of the world, that's as the US dollar is increasingly questioned. That's a bit of a way off yet. There's alternative structures being set up, the Belt and Road and BRICS, and mostly those are China led. The Global South is organizing itself, mainly led by China, to build a new multipolar world. So things are changing dramatically and quickly at the moment.
When you talk about Australia, it's the people-to-people contacts that are very important.
That's right. And you can certainly get some very cheap trips to China. There's all sorts of questions of whether the government is subsidising them there or making them cheap. There's a massive amount of growth in tourism, which is happening, which is great. I've been on a number of times to China. 580,000 Australian residents visited China last year, which is an 85% from the previous year. Of course, we had COVID before that. Chinese tourists coming to Australia are up to 890,000, which is 83% up on year on year. So there's a lot more contact, but the propaganda run by respectable media. You're talking about not just commercial media, you're talking about the ABC and SBS and Nine Media with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. It's just incredible, and people just don't understand it until they go to China and they're just amazed at what's happening there. I was travelling along the Yangtze and a group of Australians. I said, any of you engineers, because the bridge is just bridge after bridge after bridge, massive bridges crossing the Yangtze and of course the Three Gorges Dam, and you think, hey, these are incredible feats. And meanwhile, infrastructure in the West, particularly the US, is just falling and declining all the time.
So what are we going to do about Miles and his push to be a proxy for war against China?
It's a disaster. In the end, it comes down to the people of Geelong. it's just absolute disaster. Why this present government picked up the idea of AUKUS so easily, it was done on the back of the envelope by Morrison. No reason for it. It's a wedge tactic. And yet this current government, they should have said immediately in 2022, we're running an inquiry about this, and they'd come to the conclusion by an open inquiry that the thing is just not going to stand. It's getting more and more obvious it's not going to stand. It really is time, with a huge majority that the Labor Party have got in Parliament at the moment, when it certainly goes through both the House and the Senate. We need to get out of AUKUS, but perhaps the US will do the job for us in this inquiry they're running, because they can call it off, the Brits can call it off. We can only opt out by the payment of a huge amount of money, but we've already paid out a lot of money to the French for cancelling their contract. This will be even worse, but hopefully the US, with its nationalist sort of US first policy, will do the job for us and will determine that it's not good for them. They can never construct a submarine, so they're constructing about half the number of submarines at the moment that they need to construct to satisfy their own needs, and plus the needs of Australia with the AUKUS agreement. The US president must sign off on any deal which says that the submarine's going to Australia, that the US have got their needs covered. I cannot imagine Trump signing off on anything like that.
Well, also the fact that submarines are on the way out, aren't they, really?
These submarines are often the never-never. We're talking about the 2040s, probably. We might get some second-hand Virginia-class submarines before then. But the ultimate goal, you're looking at the 2040s, even the 2050s. Now, that's a long way off. That's thinking that we're going to have the biplanes that we've got flying now in 1920. They're still going to be relevant in 1950. They weren't, of course. And that's the same sort of idea. Submarine warfare may be completely outdated by then. Chinese are developing new radar that can penetrate the sea and pick these things, pick the submarines out. The reason behind AUKUS is ridiculous against our major trading partner, thinking they're going to sink their own ship. That's madness. But it's really part of an aggressive policy against China, where we're trying to hem China in through the first island defence from Korea right down to Guam. But China are ahead of the game again. They've developed a railway, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, through to the port of Gwadar in Pakistan, so they can move material through there, which opens the world to them in the Indian Ocean. And, of course, they have built massive amounts of railways across Eurasia, which take goods straight to Europe. This idea of closing China off, the greatest trading nation, off, it's just not going to happen. And of course, China have brought into BRICS as associate members, been influential in bringing in both Indonesia as a full member and Malaysia as an associate member. And of course, that's through the straits there, the Sunda Strait, and that'll enable ships to pass through there. So the whole thing behind AUKUS is redundant. The technology, we cannot be sure what's going to be in 20 years' time, the use of these submarines. And meanwhile, we're spending $368 billion, and that will rise because I think Hugh White said you've got to take any military figure and triple it. So it's just an insurmountable money amount of money, and taken from schools, hospitals, and other infrastructure that we need.
Well, finally, John, we've got to be brave and bite the bullet and stop this nonsense with the United States. It's going to cost us money and whatever to do it, if they could get brave enough to do it. But in the long run, we're going to save money.
Of course, so obvious, but there's a whole intelligence structure behind here that's been so infiltrated by US interests that keep feeding this stuff to the governments. And I don't think Albanese's main interest is in foreign affairs and international politics. He's a more a stump campaigner. Of course, you've got Miles there feeding him this sort of frightening stuff. Penny Wong's trying to counter that to some extent, but that's the internal struggle, of course, going in the government, which we can't really know that much about, but I'm sure it's there. But we've got to bite the bullet. We're following a declining empire, and we're alienating a rising nation, which is our greatest trading partner. It's economic folly. It's geopolitical silliness.
Thanks very much for today, John.
Thank you, Jan. Always good talking to you.
And you can find out more about John's writings on Substack.
3CR Radiothon 2025. Your station, your voice.
Aloha, Wumenjeka, and hello.
Buenos dias.
3CR 855 AM.
Welcome to 3CR Community Radio, dear listeners.
Community Radio at 3CR in Melbourne.
3CR Community Radio.
3CR Radio.
3CR is community owned and operated.
3CR.
3CR.
Donate to the 3CR Radiothon fundraiser this June.
To donate, call 0394198377 or go online at 3cr.org.au.
It's your station, your voice.
We don't often hear good news from the Philippines, but last week on World Environment Day, the Department of Justice threw out a move to file a grave oral defamation case against two young environmental defenders, Jed Tamano and Janila Castro, who in 2023 were abducted by the Philippines military and on reappearing 17 days later publicly revealed their abduction and captivity and exposed attempts to coerce them into falsely admitting they were rebels. This story, as I said, dates to the 2nd of September 2023. And I'm joined now by human rights activist Peter Murphy. Two young environmental defenders, September 2023, Peter. Where were they when they were abducted and what were they doing at the time?
They were in the Bataan area of near Manila Bay. That's a bit around to the north of west of Manila. They were investigating a land reclamation project, really backed in the end by the President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. So they were really looking at the social and ecological impact of the reclamation project.
And they were concerned?
Yeah. Their background is biological science. They're quite young people. They're just still students. And they were working with local communities to try to defend their interests and ascertain really what was going to happen with this project. And they were abducted off the street while just walking along the side of the road. A white van pulled up and this was captured on a CCTV. They were just bundled in and disappeared for the next 17 days.
And are these white vans like they have in, or they had in Sri Lanka, where activists would just get swept off the street and not heard of maybe forever?
That's right. That is right.
And how long before anything was heard from them?
It was the 17th of September, I think. No, 19th of September. They were brought before a media conference in a sort of a town hall situation in the province. Yeah, they were meant to be presented by this sinister state structure called the NTFLCAC, or National Task Force to End Local Communist Armed Conflict. And the military officers there presented them as surrenderees. They were, alleging that they had agreed to surrender as New People's Army members. It's very absurd. And instead, the two young women said that they actually had been abducted by the military and subjected to psychological torture and threats, had agreed to sign this statement, which was presented there, to get away from the detention.
Did they look as though they'd been badly treated?
No, they weren't physically struck or showing any signs. But later, when they recounted what they were actually put through in the interrogations, it was really they were threatened with death. They were threatened with being raped, and they were also challenged to become informants for the military and spy or report on other people. So, it was really very, very bad. And of course, to denounce each other and that sort of thing. I think I heard them give testimony in 2024 at the International People's Tribunal. And actually, it was Janila Castro gave the testimony. And she had a lot of difficulty recounting what had happened. It was very stressful or traumatic. She said that she came to the conclusion after about 15 days that they'd never get out alive unless they signed one of these statements put in front of them. So they sort of tic-tacked with each other enough to do it, yeah.
It's pretty amazing that they actually got out of this with their lives. I mean, standing up at a stage like that, did they walk away from that or did the military follow them? Or what happened after they said what they said?
Well, I think the military were stunned, but it took them, I think, just a day to file charges of perjury against the two activists. The perjury being that they'd said that they were surrenderees. But the Department of Justice then changed the charges to this grave oral defamation. So, you know, it's a slightly different idea. Instead of perjury is lying in giving evidence, and defamation is damaging the reputation of some party, in this case, the military of the Philippines. Yeah, and this case has then, you know, it's now 2025, June, and it took till, I think the case was June 4 this year, for that charge to be dismissed.
There must have been terribly distressing for them. Were they able to go back to their work as environmental defenders, or did this experience sort of calm them right down that they weren't going to put their head up to do anything after that?
No. I must say, you know, you have to admire them for their, you know, stubborn determination to, you know, stare down the military. So they just always oppose these charges, and the court system is very slow in the Philippines, but I think it was a bit slower again for them, considering how empty these charges were. But no, they've spoken out in public against the NTFLCAC consistently, and they did try to return to the project area, the issue of the land reclamation project. But they complained that the legal struggle took up so much time and effort. And, you know, Jan, behind the formal legal process, there are, you know, military and police officers harassing them. So, you know, there's this sort of informal side of it, which is, you know, much more scary in a way. I think even now, even though the charges were absolutely dismissed, the Department of Justice in the end had no evidence to present and didn't object to the quashing of the charges. So that's how bad it all was. But, you know, we should fully expect that these two people will continue to be harassed and persecuted, not in legal charges anymore, but by death threats, threats to their family, other sorts of defamation against them, you know, in posters, on banners, and on social media.
But their case must have given a big flip-up to other environmental defenders and human rights defenders, that they could take the military on and win. You say it's a small victory, but it's still a victory.
It's a real victory. No, I've got no doubt about it. You know, I'm trying to be realistic about the overall context in which Jed and Janila are going to continue to work. But, you know, this was a very, very embarrassing setback for the NTFLCAC. And it immediately, when this acquittal or the quashing of these charges happened, the cry went out across many organisations for the NTFLCAC to be abolished. So this is, I think, a good you know, important victory. But it's, you know, there are many other cases, unfortunately, Jan, of you know, particularly young women who are active in either environmental or other, you know, Indigenous struggles, being abducted and charged with completely ridiculous allegations and then having to fight their way out of it. So, you know, it's sort of relentless. I think the people in the Philippines see these victories as you know, real achievements, real milestones, but they know that it's all just part of a much bigger struggle. That's where we're at, I think.
How much publicity has this case had?
When they were acquitted, it got mainstream media coverage, of course, you know, because it is really extreme that the judicial system in the Philippines is used in this way. It's completely wrong. You know, we can talk a bit further about it, but obviously the Department of Justice was abusing its role. It shouldn't be prosecuting people on completely fabricated charges. The lawyers who carry these tasks out for the Department of Justice, you know, they're really flagrantly abusing their role as officers of the court. The judges who tolerate this process going on to the point, you know, when they finally have a hearing, and now there's no evidence, you know. well, they've wasted, you know, months and months of court time as well. So, yeah, I think it's a scandalous situation. And unfortunately, looking at it from outside, you know, the international community is still not willing to really call this out. So we call it lawfare. You know, in Australia we have a bit of it, but in the Philippines it's a massive operation, and, you know, it really undermines the idea of the rule of law.
I'm just wondering whether anyone in the Philippines who are fighting for justice gets a fair go in the judicial system in the Philippines.
Obviously, eventually some do. You know, eventually some of these murder charges and, you know, carrying explosive charges and this defamation one, you know, they finally get exposed and they're thrown out. But for the number that we see ending in this sort of victory, there's now 50 more who we never hear of and who are languishing in jail, either sentenced or awaiting trial for years and years. That's why it's a bit grim, really. And you have to really, really celebrate these victories like Jed and Janilla had.
Another issue with the Philippines that you've been covering is the possible impeachment of Sara Duterte. What's the latest?
There was a sort of a murky process last week whereby the Senate, in a way, agreed to proceed with the impeachment, and at the same time delayed the impeachment till July. July is when the new senators take their places and the numbers change in the Senate. And as well as that, they managed to refer the impeachment motion back to the House of Representatives, you know, where it was originated, to request them to check whether it was really constitutional or not. It looks like the House of Representatives agreed to that. That's absurd because the Constitution is really clear, you know, if the House of Representatives carries the motion by the required number of votes to impeach somebody, then it must be tried in the Senate. There's no referring it back from the Senate or anything like that. The only body which could possibly adjudicate on this is the Supreme Court. And they've played no role in this particular manoeuvre. So what we're really seeing is the Duterte supporters in the Senate undermining the Constitution. Now, it's hard to know what's going on behind the scenes, but I imagine that, you know, Marcos and his people are reassessing, you know, how to deal with the Dutertes after the midterm election result. And they may well want, you know, to stop this impeachment process. There's a huge outcry in the public that this is completely wrong and that the impeachment trial must take place. So there's a bit of a standoff really developing between the sort of political elite and the public. So this, I imagine, it's very damaging both to the Dutertes and to the Marcoses, that aspect of it. But, you know, they're very arrogant and they don't really think they have to answer to anybody. We'll probably see some more and really weird statements coming out of the Senate or the House of Representatives in the next couple of weeks. But I think we have to wait till July for it to sort of, crystallise.
And what are the change numbers in the Senate?
I think that we have 1-6 senators, so that instead of 24, there's 23. And then there's a need for a two-thirds majority for an impeachment to be carried. So that means 16 votes in favour. So 9 is required. 16 and 8 is 24. Yeah, so 9 is required to block. And I think that with the Senate election, the midterm election, the Dutertes probably have the 9. It's hard to be sure, but it's close. Could be 7, could be 8, could be 9. Some of the senators are obviously sort of up for sale to some extent, and that gives the Marcoses some sort of room to campaign to be sure of getting the numbers if they really want to proceed with this. If the impeachment goes through, then Sara Duterte could not be a candidate in the presidential election in 2028. I think that's the main thing on the minds of the elite over there, you know, who's going to run. Because there's a sort of a war going on now between the Marcos family and the Duterte family, the stakes are very high. And I think you can say from the midterm elections, the Dutertes have got a bit of momentum, and the Marcoses, you know, didn't do so well. Therefore, you know, going towards 2028, it could well be the Dutertes come back and Sarah gets to be the president, which would be a pretty bleak outlook. But, you know, much the same as having a Marcos as the president, it's pretty bleak for the people.
You're saying that an outcome of the impeachment process, if she's found guilty, I suppose that's the word, is that she yes. can't stand. What other penalties are there?
I think the main one is she cannot be the vice president anymore, and she cannot stand for public office ever again. So it's a political punishment.
Aren't they criminal charges that she was facing?
No. The impeachment under the Constitution is for certain specific sorts of things. So a sort of malfeasance thing, like, you know, abuse of funds is one of the charges against her. And, you know, bringing her office into disrepute is another. The key things alleged against her are that she was awarded, you know, the equivalent in peso of $10.5 million in discretionary and intelligence funds. And she spent it all within a week. And therefore, they're alleging, the members of the House of Representatives are alleging that she couldn't possibly have spent it properly on intelligence or other duties of the vice president. The other main charge is that she publicly, you know, on the media, threatened to kill the president, his Speaker of the House, Romualdez, and the president's wife in the event that she was killed. You know, the threat to assassinate the president is pretty severe. And I think it's completely proper that she's being impeached myself. So, that's the core of it. But the outcome, the penalty is as I said. Separately, if that happened, perhaps you could expect the Department of Justice to do the right thing and then pursue a criminal case. But, you know, the House of Representatives is not really like the Department of Justice.
Well, we know that she's Duterte's daughter. Yep. What's her political history like?
Well, she's been a very loyal daughter for Rodrigo Duterte. When he became president, he stopped being the mayor of Davao in 2016, and she was the candidate who replaced him. When she became the vice president, her brother replaced her. Sort of a dynastic sort of block. She and her two brothers and her father occupying these fairly important political roles. Like her father, she's a sort of a strong-arm character. So one of the more colourful things about her is that one of her officials in Davao Municipal Council was reporting to her on some development issue, and she didn't like, you know, what he said, so she just punched him in the face. It was all on camera. She's a person who really, with a short temper, who's aggressive, you know, physically aggressive, and has no compunction in pursuing people. When she was the vice president, initially she became the head of the NTFL-CAC. The president theoretically is, but he, you know, delegated that to her, and she started pursuing the teachers. So she was trying to crush the teachers' union, the Alliance of Concerned Teachers, and she was really very ruthless about it. So, we had teachers being shot, we had teachers having nervous breakdowns, people resigning, you know, union leaders having to go into hiding. This is just in the last couple of years. There's nothing good in prospect if she becomes the president.
So we wait for July for her.
Yes.
And we
yes.
wait for September for her father.
The next hearing is for him, I think it's September 23, yes. So Rodrigo Duterte will appear before a panel of judges in The Hague, but it will still be a sort of preliminary hearing. And they're going to just make a ruling on whether the evidence put forward by the prosecution is broadly capable of finding him guilty of the charges. That's just a sort of like a committal hearing. We would understand that here in Australia. But in between now and then, his lawyers are continually putting forward motions that he should be released on bail, or he should be released because he's ill, released so that he can go back to the Philippines. So there's a con- you know, constant pressure on the ICC to step back from what they've done. But I don't expect any of that will be successful, and that he will appear before that panel in September.
Well, Peter, finally, whether he's found guilty or not, it's a warning to other despots around the world, surely, that your time might come.
Yes, yes, it is. You know, I think he will be found guilty, but, you know, that is up to the trial process. But I have been involved in helping to accumulate the evidence that is being used against him. And, of course, he's his own worst enemy in the sense that he gave so many speeches saying that he is a murderer, saying that he supports rape. So he being charged with the crime against humanity of murder, I think it's an uphill battle for him to defeat that charge.
We shall hear more. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Jan.
I've been speaking with Peter Murphy, human rights activist from Sydney.
Been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.